There's a lot of stuff going on, and this is what you need to know about today.
A deep strike Ukrainian drone unit launching this night a wave of 200 attack drones into Russia.
I hesitate to call him a journalist.
Other presidents have looked at this for 50, 60 years. It looks like I'll be the one that does it.
Cuba's in a lot of trouble. It's run by a bunch of incompetent communists.
Really? Was it incompetent communists who've destroyed the economy of Cuba, or was it the crushing and cruel economic sanctions that have been there for almost 70 years now on the necks of the Cuban people? We're going to break this down for you with Professor Danny Shaw, who's just returned from Cuba. And boy, does he have stories to tell. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And yes, it looks like the Iran situation is about to blow up again. Why I say that is because of this. Israel is determined, hell-bent, to take over Lebanon. They're going in even though they know it will destroy U.S. talks with Iran. But they don't care. They don't give a crap, right? They want to provoke Iran again so that way the U.S. has to end up coming to their defense, Israel's defense, and then, voila, the war is back on. Expect it. You heard it here first. All right, I want to talk to you now about something else. I want to talk to you about what the United States is doing in Cuba. Maybe I should say this a little differently. Maybe I should choose different words. Maybe I should describe it as what the United States has been doing in Cuba for 66 years now. This is kind of a painful story for me. See, I was born in Cuba, and I grew up in the other Cuba, Miami. So in many ways, this story is part of my own personal story, right? It's my history, too. What did Rudyard Kipling call it on If? He said, it's part of my nerve, it's part of my sinew, right? Cuba happens to be one of the most beautiful islands in the entire world. Mountains, beaches, waterfalls, lush valleys. Its coastline is so crystal clear, so magnificent. Christopher Columbus, when he first laid eyes on this island, he said, after surveying the rest of the Americas, that Cuba was the most beautiful land that man's eyes had yet beheld. We all grew up with that quote. Of course, then he proceeded to rape and slaughter just about everybody on the island, and that's part of the problem. That's maybe where the whole thing began. So look, this is Cuba's history in a nutshell, so you understand it. Cuba was enslaved by Spain, corrupted and prostituted by America, and then lied to and abandoned by the Soviets. And now, here we are again. And this time it's Donald Trump and Marco Rubio who are turning up the heat.
The Cubans, look, it's a failed country. Everybody knows it. They don't have electricity. They don't have money. They don't have really anything. They don't have food. And we're going to help them along, and we're going to help them because the people, because number one, I want to help them. Other presidents have looked at this for 50, 60 years doing something, and it looks like I'll be the one that does it.
Cuba's in a lot of trouble because, unfortunately, for them, it's run by a bunch of incompetent communists. And being communist is bad. Being an incompetent communist is, like, the worst.
That's not honest. That's not honest. In fact, Marco Rubio's comment right there, that's a lie. I'm not here to vouch for the competence or incompetence of the people who administrate or the politicians in Cuba, okay? But it really, think about it, takes a lot of nerve to slowly destroy a country economically over six decades, squeezing every penny, every opportunity that they could possibly have so that they can't buy, they can't sell, they can't bank, they can't trade, they can't share their goods or their services with practically any country on earth, and then call them incompetent. Takes a lot of nerve. I mean, really? Look, there is no country on earth, no country on earth that has felt the weight of the boot on their necks like what the U.S. hegemony has done to Cuba for the past almost 70 years. None, no other country has felt something like this for so long. It began in the 1960s, 62, actually. That's when they decided, the U.S. did, to blockade the island with an economic embargo. And from that point, Cuba was canceled, decoupled economically, politically, and culturally from a country that it was 90 miles away. It was meant to destroy Cuba, right? That blockade, the embargo, didn't work. The Cuban Revolution actually improved conditions for the average Cuban at the beginning. For the first time, there was free education in Cuba. For the first time in its history, everybody on the island also had free health care. And they had quality medicine. Poverty on the island was slashed like by 60 or 70% under the Cuban Revolution. Cuba became an inspiration for countries all over the world. Why? Because they were standing up to the United States. But that was its undoing, too, right? Think about it. That didn't sit well with Washington. So in the 1990s, Washington doubled down. This time, they were going to go in for the kill. First, they passed the Cuban Democracy Act of 1992. And then they followed that up with the Helms-Burton Act of 1996. I remember this. I talked to Mr. Burton. And I watched it. And I covered it. Badly, by the way. I was young. In that moment, though, with those laws, Cuba became probably the first full, real target of what we now recognize as the U.S. banking and trade hegemony. It's what countries like Russia and Iran are experiencing now, and others. Laws passed to make sure that nobody will trade with you. Nobody's allowed to bank with you. Because if they do, we, the United States, will go after them. We will punish them, too. So countries stay away from you, right? There are laws that over time have really crippled Cuba. Crippled this once magnificent Caribbean island. The laws even made it possible for people like me, Cuban Americans, living in the United States, to not be able to visit our families in Cuba. You can't go, we were told, unless they were dying and you wanted to see them one last time or take them some kind of medicine or something. There were a couple of exceptions. But it was cruel, right? Was it unjust? Of course it was unjust. But it kind of worked. Those laws, that pressure that was applied by the United States, it's pretty much destroyed Cuba. Yeah, the United States has destroyed Cuba, not incompetent communists, which is why it's so rich to now hear Mr. Trump and Mr. Rubio say that they want to save it without copping to having broken it in the first place. It's just dishonest, that's all. You know, maybe they're going to do something that ends up being better. You never know. I can't tell the future. But in just a bit, I'm going to be joined by Danny Shaw. He's just gotten back from Cuba. And he was there to see it with his own two eyes. And he's going to share with us some of his videos and what he actually saw and expects to happen now. So yesterday I played a clip, right? It was from Bloomberg, remember? And I showed how Western reporters lie to you. I broke it down point by point. Many of you reached out to me. Thank you very much. Thousands of comments on this. People like this. We're going to do more of this, right? So, by the way, if you missed it, you can go back to go to the RT website and you'll see it right there. Click shows. And then you'll see a weird picture of me looking like this on the side. And you can hit that and you'll see yesterday's show. So in that report, I showed how they carefully manipulated language and how they omitted facts to frame the story to create a false narrative. That's what they do. Here's another case, though. I found another one for you. This one's different, though. This time it's CNN that does it. They don't even try to hide it. They're bragging about what they do. Let me explain this to you. So you know those drone attacks that you've been reading about? You probably heard about the ones that took place in Moscow, where in the middle of the night, 1,000 drones hit, like, apartment buildings in Moscow, right? Obviously, who lives in apartment buildings? People, civilians, regular people like you and me, right? So it was a civilian target. There's no doubt about that. Those drones are hitting civilian targets. Then there was the school dormitory that killed 21 students in the middle of the night. Remember that one right there in the Donbass? That was an obvious and intentional strike on a civilian target. You know, I was there. I saw it, right? This means it was a war crime. It's a war crime. You're not allowed to target civilians. Well, this is crazy. Here is CNN doing a report bragging about how they're there, right there with Ukraine, while Ukraine is lobbing these drones at civilians in Russia. This is CNN. If this were any other country, they would be calling it terrorism. But it's like they're there watching the terrorism that they would call if it were anywhere else. They're right there by the... You've got to see this. Here, just play it, Gene.
We're now with perhaps Russia's most keenly sought target in the war. A deep strike Ukrainian drone unit launching this night a wave of 200 attack drones into Russia.
Potentially 20 drones being launched just from here, and three or four other locations around here also involved in tonight's attack. The sheer number overwhelming, it seems, much of Russia's air defences and causing persistent embarrassment to the Kremlin.
Oh, yeah. It's embarrassing for the Kremlin that people who live in Moscow are mad because somebody is shooting drones at their apartment buildings. Look what he's saying. Last night on my live stream that airs at 7 p.m. right after this show, you can catch it live, by the way, on any of the socials. It's on It's on X and it's on BitChute live for sure. And then it plays as well on YouTube. So on that show last night, I was talking to KJ. No, I love KJ. He's a really smart guy. And he's an international expert on war, an international expert on laws that affect wars and geopolitics. And here's what he said when I played this video for him.
Well, I mean, it's a war crime and it's terror. I mean, it is completely against all the rules of international law. And the fact that he is using that as some kind of point that Ukraine has scored against Russia speaks to the utter and total depravity of that. I hesitate to call him a journalist.
I would call him a terrorist. I mean, isn't that what he would call someone who was doing that? If he was doing the story and instead of being Ukraine, it was Iran, right? Or it was Hezbollah, right? Who were firing rockets into Israel. What would he say they are? He would say those are terrorists shooting at civilian targets. But it's Ukraine shooting at Russians, so then it's a legitimate story all of a sudden. How is that? That's KJ No. I want to show you somebody who, though mild-mannered and outward in appearance, is as effective and as fearless when standing up to these Western media lies as anybody in the world today. Professor Mohammad Mirandi recently exhibited a master class on how to deal with smug Western reporters who lie outright and who think they're always right, and everybody else, like the rest of us, are just beneath them because they live in this little bubble, right? This thing happened a while ago, but I still think it's a good example of how to treat, how you should respond to these people. Here's the first cut I want to share with you. Here is this talking head interviewer from London, of course, who seemed to have her background information that she did for the interview. She did it in 5 minutes by watching CNN, probably. She's insisting on this made-up, now disproven story that Iran slaughtered 40, 50, 60,000 protesters. Here it is.
That's your regime propaganda. And of course, you're pro-regime.
Well, no, I'm asking you. I'm asking you. I'm asking you straightforward questions. And I am asking you a question which relates to the deaths of tens of thousands of protesters.
Don't be cowardly. Let me answer. Those 3,117 people who were killed, it's your responsibility and the responsibility of your regimes, because you sent terrorists and gave them weapons to slaughter hundreds of police officers and men and countless people on the streets in order to create armed insurrection.
You know, Mirandi literally coined the term the Epstein class. Did you know that? Yeah, he's the guy who made up that word. And it's had a viral effect because people are using it now all over the world, right? This talking head apparently doesn't like it when he uses that term. She's upset by the fact that he uses the term the Epstein class. So she says, why are you using that word, the Epstein class? Here's his answer.
It's very clear what class of people are in charge in your countries. That class of people are the people who have control. They're the ones who own the media. They're the ones who control the government. They're the ones who start unprovoked wars time after time. This is not the first war that you've imposed upon this region, or Iran for that matter. And we just saw yesterday a key American anti-terrorist official resigned, saying the truth that we all knew, but you tried to hide. And that is, Iran was no threat to the United States, and that this war was carried out because of the Israeli regime and its powerful lobby. So what I'm saying is basically what he is saying. That powerful lobby is the Epstein class.
Do you ever worry that people might struggle to take you seriously with phrases, language, conspiracy theories like that?
Well, that intelligence officer basically said what I am saying. And I think that people don't really take you seriously. And as time goes on and you continue to help B-52 bombers carpet bomb Tehran and people in this neighborhood, and they're seriously dead. Take that seriously. They die. You don't care, but we do.
I love what he did there. Take me serious? Those people being carpet bombed, they're seriously dead. That's an interesting way to turn a phrase. Finally here, she's insulted him, right? She's lied to him. Not being able to really lay a glove on him throughout the entire interview. I really enjoyed watching this. I was like, go, 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 Mr. Professor Mirandi. Now she throws another Western made-up narrative at him that we know is not true because I was there in Iran. And who would know better, by the way? She's interviewing a guy from Iran, right? He's there in Iran. And she's insisting to him, no, the new Ayatollah is dead, isn't he? He's dead, isn't he? And he's saying, no, he's not dead. Watch, here's his response.
You can make all the claims that you want. After all, that's what Western media does.
No, it was a simple question. I'm just asking whether there's any proof. Not everything's a trick. I'm asking whether there's any proof that he is still alive. There are some reports he's dead.
Yeah,
there are some reports that he's in Russia seeking treatment. Is he in the country and is he alive and well?
Russia.
That's a ridiculous claim to say that he's in Russia seeking treatment, or he's dead in Iran, or he was killed already. That just shows that these are just your narratives. He's leading the country, and the U.S. empire is collapsing, and the world has turned against you, and your regime is part of the carpet bombing. You helped the carpet bombing in Tehran,
okay,
and across the country, and the world will not forget what you did.
Professor,
and the world will not forget your propagandists either.
Professor Mohammed Mirandi.
Nor will your grandchildren.
Professor of...
Nor will your grandchildren. Nor will your grandchildren. I mean, masterclass on how to deal with these people. Because you got to call them out. You got to call it as it is. You got to tell them what they are. And he did it. Anyway, look, as promised, I want to go back to the story I told you about at the beginning of the show, the place where I was born. Joining us now to do that is Professor Danny Shaw. He teaches Latin American history. He has just returned from Cuba, where he has filed reports about what's happening there right now. He's a good man. He's been on our shows before. We've had lots of conversation. It's a pleasure to be able to welcome him to the Sanchez Effect. Danny, how are you, sir?
Good to see you again, Rick, and thank you for treating this issue with such honesty that we never hear about here in the U.S. They want the entire U.S. population to live in the same Marco Rubio Trump bubble that you referenced.
What do you think of that? What do you think of the idea that Mr. Rubio, who you know that I know, and I grew up in Miami with him, and to hear him and Mr. Trump refer to Cuba as this wasteland, this mess, I think they said, this place that has to be fixed because they don't know what they're doing down there and they've destroyed their own country. When anybody with half a lick of sense or even just a book to open and read will tell you that that's not the case. Cuba was destroyed by the United States. They brag about that. And if they want to fix it, that's good. But don't tell me that it wasn't broken by you, right?
It's hypocritical. It's dishonest. U.S. foreign policy for 67 years now has done everything to disrupt the Cuban economy, any sense of social and economic harmony. No different than the Israelis and the U.S., the State Department taking a scalpel every day fully aware of the average caloric intake that Palestinians have access to in Gaza. The State Department, all these different agencies, the CIA, they know exactly how many calories Cubans have access to, and every day it's less. I witnessed an incredible amount of hunger, of despair, of deprivation, of thirst, a lack of water. And for someone like Marco Rubio, who is so arrogant and backed by billions and billions of dollars coming from the Adelsons and Israel and other billionaire families, it's completely out of step with the reality of the Cuban people. And the Cuban people know who they're enemies are, and they're asking, where are our friends? Why do we deserve to suffer so much? So you have a population in decline, more out migration every day, vulnerable people dying away. So Cuba's up against a serious demographic challenge of depopulation, and this is really a climax point of that.
Yeah, we're looking at your pictures here, and it's really sad to look at. I mean, some of these people look like they don't even have clothes to put on their backs. It looks like it looks miserable. It looks rough. It looks as bad as I've ever seen it. And as you know, I've been there a few times, and it just seems like it's gotten worse and worse. And I would imagine that these latest measures that the Trump administration has put on Cuba have been squeezing them even more, right? Because it was bad before, but it's worse, right? Isn't that your story?
That's the story. Every day it gets worse, and Cubans are more and more desperate. I mean, when you blockade food, when you don't allow agriculture to get to Holguín or Havana or Santiago, the major metropolises, this just causes more hunger. And I traveled across Cuba. I was able to do that because I have access to dollars. Cubans who don't have access to dollars, they can't go into the private economy. They can't go to what's called the MIPIMES. They're shut out. So it's a type of Cuban economic apartheid, because it's not Cuba that's blockaded, it's the Cuban people. If you have access to the private sector, you can import gasoline, you can import food. So people should understand that, you know, roughly 2% of Cuba is doing fine. They do have access to dollars, euros, and foreign reserves, but overwhelmingly who are called el cubano de a pie. And I've been studying Cuban Spanish, Cuban lingo, slang, vocabulary. I'm an ethnolinguist since 1995. These things deserve just the utmost attention and detail. And my reports that I'm filing have tried to show the truth about Cuba. This is a humanitarian disaster. This is Gaza without bombs.
So help me understand this. I'm very familiar with the MIPIMES because I've talked to some of the officials who organized it. I thought for a while, and by the way, for the benefit of our audience, MIPIMES were essentially stores that started springing up in Cuba where, I guess, business people started creating a place where people could go and buy supplies and foodstuffs, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought for a while, hey, maybe this is the beginning of something that could lead to some kind of market or commerce that is successful in Cuba. And the government seemed to be going along with it for a while. What happened there? Is that part of the problem, or is that part of the solution?
Yeah, those are great questions. The MIPIMES, these micro, small, and medium-sized entrepreneurial projects. And in theory, they would open up the economy to, quote unquote, free trade and everything.
Yeah.
The problem is it's capital coming from Miami or from Madrid, from Cuban Americans, from foreigners, and it's in dollars, where the Cuban peso is worth less every day. The problem per se is not just private property unto itself. It's that the vast majority of Cubans, I'd say the 99%, are shut out of the possibility of going there and buying, purchasing. So hyperinflation and the devaluation of the Cuban people's currency, everyday prices for basic goods go up and the value of their currency goes down. And that's the recipe for this economic genocide that we're witnessing.
So explain to our audience, okay, I'm a basic guy living in Cuba. I don't have access to dollars. I don't have access to any other currency except the Cuban peso. Why don't I have access to any other currency other than the Cuban peso? Any other person living in any other country in the world would be able to go to a currency exchange place and change their money if they had to. Why can't Cubans do that?
The war on Cuba has been an economic war. It's been a monetary war. It's been a bank war. It's the accumulation over decades and decades. The special period began in 1991. The Soviet Union's no longer there. There's no longer East Germany and a socialist bloc. And you have this tiny island 90 miles off the coast of Miami left to fend for itself. So it's an accumulation of deprivation, of isolation. And my reference point is Haiti. I'm an ethnographer who spent years and years in Haiti. I speak the language fluently. And even in Cuba, I saw less toys and less consumer goods and yeah. less food. Collectively than across Haiti. If that doesn't cry that this is a humanitarian disaster, I don't know what is. Something has to give. The Cubans ask every day, what about the Russians, the Chinese, the Vietnamese? Can't they do something for us? Because we're completely blockaded, and it sharpens every day.
Is there any doubt, before we move on to solutions or what's going to happen post this, is there any doubt in your mind that the reason the people in Cuba have access to nothing and are practically starving is because that's how the United States wants them to be, and it's how the United States hegemony has created the situation for them to be in those conditions. Is there anything that I just said that is not accurate?
You're 1,000% correct. The unofficial religion of the ruling class in the U.S. is anti-socialism, it's anti-communism, it's anti any type of collective system that could give any ounce of social justice, whether it's to Mexicans, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, Bolivians, or Cubans. This is an unfettered war against Cuba. And these are the shocking results that we're seeing. I got in there. I traveled as much as I could. I tried to walk 10, 15 kilometers per day to cover as much as many city blocks as I could across Centro Havana, in the different neighborhoods and barrios and ghettos. And then I traveled all the way across the country to Santiago. I stopped in Las Tunas and Sancti Spiritus, because if things are tough in Havana and the metropolitan center, imagine in the least visited regions of the country like Guantanamo and Las Tunas.
Before the Cuban Revolution, before Fidel Castro, there was a guy named Fulgencio Batista, who was the leader of Cuba. He was a extremely corrupt American puppet who literally would have suitcases of hundreds of thousands of cash in cash delivered to him on a weekly basis. He had a relationship with the U.S. mafia. Conditions in Cuba for the wealthy was actually really good. It was good to be in Cuba in the 1950s if you were wealthy or if you had a job in one of the sugar plants, et cetera, et cetera. But if you were lower middle class to poor, it was horrible. Cuba was just as poor for them as it is now for the people of Cuba, except that it was better in Cuba back then for those people who were doing well. So I guess my question is, the thinking for people like me who know the history of Cuba is that what comes next for Cuba is going to resemble something like what Batista had in the past. In fact, let me just add a caveat. Mr. Trump wanted to own one of those mob casinos in Cuba, and I can show you the filings for him trying to do so. Are you there, Danny?
Yeah, it just faded out for a second. I apologize. I lost the audio there for a second.
Did you hear what I said? Did you hear what I said at the end?
Yeah, Trump looking out for his own interests. Yeah, I mean, that's what they're going to do. They're trying to open up Cuba, but it appears they want to disempower and hurt and murder through hunger. I mean, a lack of water. You go through Camagüey, you go through Holguín, and there's a complete lack of running water. People have nothing to drink. I mean, this is a recipe for, at what point do we begin to use the words like humanitarian disaster or economic genocide? When is the correct point? My job as an ethnographer is to take the pulse of the revolution, to take the pulse of every day. So Cubans feel like they have no choice but to follow the quote-unquote lead, the death lead of Goliath. They know there's no way that they can resist an economy. The U.S. economy is $30 trillion. The U.S. The Cuban economy for this year is projected to be less than $100 billion, which is eight times less than the income and wealth of Elon Musk, one individual capitalist.
Wow.
So what choice do the Cubans have? David versus Goliath, they feel they have no choice. So for me, it's not so much an ideological political question these days. It's a humanitarian question. How can we save as many Cuban lives as possible, given this incredibly difficult terrain?
Well, let's do this, you and I. Let's suppose you're right, and we're both right, and it sucks, and I hate it. And the fact that you and I both know, and most people with half a brain know, that the United States has been so cruel and has really had its boot on the necks of Cubans for the last 66 years, and they've created these conditions that have put Cuba here. Okay, but let's set that aside. And let's look at it, perhaps, glass half full. Say what you want about Donald Trump, say what you want about Marco Rubio. What if it works? Maybe it's time for a change in Cuba. Is there a possibility that maybe through his madness, Donald Trump going in there and trying to fix this broken country could be exactly what might be the only solution for this broken country at this particular place and time? Even if we admit that it's only broken because the U.S. broke it, but if they're willing to fix it, should we say, okay, let's try?
Well, I don't know if I'd frame it quite that way. I mean, look, the Cuban people, all they want to do is be left alone. If they want to trade with the Venezuelans, with the Vietnamese, they should be allowed to, but they're not allowed to. So then within the framework of this war on Cuba, this genocidal war on Cuba, what options do the Cubans have? I mean, what I hear from the everyday Cuban people, and a lot of our audience is not going to like this, but everyday Cubans say, if they're going to bomb us now. If they're going to invade us, please do it now, because these bombs of hunger, these bombs of dehydration are killing us. So I just have to speak to the absolute urgency. Cubans are sick of debates and politics. And what voice do the Cuban people have? And I think it's a deep question to look at the Cuban state. This is not the same Cuban state as 1991 or 1989 or 1959. Mm-hmm. We need a deep, honest evaluation of the Cuban state and how they've gone along with private capital. You don't hear the Cuban state talking about all of this hunger, and they're not putting out the images of what their people are going through every day. And I think that's dishonest as well. So there's many ingredients in place that are depriving the everyday Cuban people of a voice.
Let me show you a Politico headline that just came out. And let's take a look at this together, and we'll share our own background on this with our audience. First of all, you have to understand, those of you at home, that Politico is basically an arm of the U.S. State Department. They write whatever the State Department wants them to write. So this is a story that was fed to them by Marco Rubio, or by maybe even somebody in the White House, because they want this story out there. So it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen. But the headline says, Danny, Pentagon puts building blocks in place for Cuba invasion. So we are being told that the United States is about to invade Cuba. First of all, what do you make of that?
It appears so. They have surrounded Cuba now with one of their largest aircraft carriers. This is a country that is in no position to defend itself, with the vast majority of Cubans brought to their knees with extreme hunger, dehydration, everything that I've been documenting, addiction, alcoholism. When you can't eat, you naturally, it's the law of the jungle. Things I've seen in Cuba, I've never seen in Haiti. And again, there's no other comparison. Wow. I could ever make. That's not to say that Cuba overall is worse than Haiti, but the fact that they're in the same conversation. So they'll go in, they'll probably take out some Cuban missile, some Cuban base, not a missile base. I'm thinking it's 1962 or something, near Guantanamo. Maybe they'll abduct or kidnap the soon to be 95-year-old Raul Castro. So they already have the Department of Justice has their headlines and their paperwork, the CIA talking points, Politico, the New York Times, the Miami Herald. But how is the objective situation of the Cubans going to change if there's some invasion? They're not invading with food. They're not invading with humanitarian supplies. They're invading with more guns and more drones. And this whole headline trying to justify the invasion, that Cuba has 300 mysterious drones, as if 300 drones would mean anything to the largest military empire in the history of the world.
What do the people tell you when you talk about them about their fears? They've got to be some real concerns. I mean, I remember I was in Iran just before the United States started bombing the Iranians, and I remember stopping in the streets and talking to everyone, mothers, children, hardliners, people who were on both positions, mullahs, you name it. And it was interesting to talk to a people on the verge of an attack. What perspective did you get? What perspective did you get from the people of Cuba when you talked to them about what seems to be an attack that could come any day now from the United States?
Overwhelmed, stressed, fearful, insomnia, a certain genocidal insomnia. Cubans Everyday Cuban's family slogan is, if we can give a plate to a food to our children today, today was a successful day. The problem is we have to get up tomorrow and do it all over. Cubans are wary of the immediate future. They feel completely disempowered. They don't feel like they have a government that's defending their interests. They see these fancy, nice cars flying by them. They see these MIPIMES where only a small percentage of the population can even go. So they really don't think it can get worse. And in some type of contradictory way, I think they know the invasion is going to come. And they're like, let's just be done with this so we can somehow move on. Because whatever this is hunger, this is genocidal. We need some type of change. Some Cubans contact me from Pinar del Río or whatever area of Havana, I think just to see if their WhatsApp still works, because there's less electricity. There's less Wi-Fi. They have no way of communicating with the outside world. And that was the type of intellectual mission that I was on, being a witness to history.
Yeah, I was born in Guanabacoa. I went there not long ago. It was it's kind of like a working man's town where my parents
were. It's intense. I was in Guanabacoa, Regla. I walked those streets. It's intense.
Yeah, I can only imagine. What do you think Mr. Trump and Mr. Rubio and their handlers have in mind for Cuba? What do you think they want to do with it? I mean, okay, fine. So let's suppose you go in there with troops. Now you own it, right? As Powell used to say, you broke it, you own it, right? Now what? What are they going to do with it?
The spearhead is this private capital that we've been talking about, which didn't just begin in 2021 with the law of the MIPIMES. And Marco Rubio and Trump, they're spokespeople for this billionaire class, this Epstein class. And they're going to go in and they're going to buy up the waterfronts. They want the Cuban government, which was the arbiter, the economic arbiter, which defended national interests on some level, despite whatever critiques people have. They want them completely out of the way, and they want to buttress up this private sector. I don't think they're afraid to sacrifice millions of Cubans. 2.5 million Cubans have already perished and migrated just in the past few years. They're not afraid to depopulate the Caribbean. This is a campaign of depopulation of Puerto Rico through gentrification and the buying up of the waterfront. They use these paramilitary gangs in Haiti to depopulate the capital of Haiti. This is a massive depopulation campaign of Cuba. I think they've defined a lot of quote-unquote third world people as excessive. And if they die the way the Palestinians are, 4 million displaced in Iran, and then they have the audacity to point the finger at the Iranian government that they're the ones who's repressing, it's completely hypocritical. But it does, in my mind, constitute a type of economic genocidal campaign against the Cuban people.
So they're going to own, the word doesn't come to mind right now, but there is a word for when you go in and you just take over somebody else's land, right? And this is what it seems the United States wants to do. I'm not an international law scholar, but I would certainly think that it's not legal to go into somebody's country and simply take over swaths of land or buildings or, as you said, shoreline, just so you can then sell it to some business person in Las Vegas so he can make a casino or whatever the hell he's going to do with it, right?
I have a graduate degree in international law, and that's quite embarrassing because it's paper law. It's a complete joke. When has the U.S. ever respected international law as they send more and more weapons of, deadly weapons to the Ukrainians to spoke more war, when they're responsible for the displacement of 1.5 million Lebanese, the invasions of all these different countries, Panama, 1989, Grenada, 1983, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no consideration of international law or of honesty in general. So that's why the Cuban people feel like they're trapped in a whirlwind, in a colonial whirlwind, but they want to survive somehow, some way. Right now in Cuba, it's the law of the jungle. If you gave a plate of food to your elderly neighbor for the past 20 years, and no matter what, you could at least give her a little bit of bread, a little bit of something. Today, you can't, and that woman dies, and she's anonymous, and her name never appears anywhere.
We've come a long way, haven't we, Danny, when you think of what happened during, for example, both the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs. There was a time when the government of Fidel Castro was so strong and so forthright, whether it was really strong and whether it actually can do the things that it said it could do, we'll never know, although we did see a good example of that. during the Bay of Pigs. There it is, where the Cubans essentially stood up to the United States military under something that under the Kennedy administration took place. The Kennedys didn't want it. It was planned during the Eisenhower administration, but it happened during the Kennedy administration. And it made Fidel Castro a folk hero worldwide. He stood up to the United States and defeated them the way Iran is defeating the United States right now. And then for decades after that, Cuba really seemed to be able to defiantly stand up to America. And it was kind of something interesting to watch. And people all over the world took note. That's a far cry from what we're seeing right now, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, my first time, Rick, ever going to Cuba was as one of these brigadistas, one of these international missions to break the blockade. I was 16 years old. I was in 1995. I just returned from basketball tournaments where Allen Iverson and Kobe Bryant were the big names. I think you and I are more or less contemporaries in the same age range. And I've been studying Cuba, visiting Cuba, notebooks and notebooks of notes on Cuba since 1995. And I don't think on the left we have the luxury as anti-imperialists to just assume that this Cuban leadership is the same Cuban leadership of the Ernesto Che Guevara's and the Camilo Cienfuegos, Aide Santa Maria, all of these different names, of course, Fidel being the biggest folk hero. I think things have really changed. So I think there is a power grab, a power group within Cuba that might be one of the ingredients within this silent economic genocide that's playing out. Hmm. And all I know is the Cuban people are the ones trapped in the middle. So looking for solutions is very difficult. I wish I could give more words of hope, but my responsibility is to give the sobering reality of what the everyday Cuban people are going through in areas that are completely neglected. CNN's not going to go to Las Tunas, and Fox could care less about Pinar del Rio. So how do we get out their truth as well?
Yeah. CNN doesn't know their own butt. I can't believe I just said that on TV. I apologize, but it's true.
Candid moment.
What happens next? Okay, they got Venezuela. They're about to take Cuba. Brazil? Ecuador?
The Sandinistas.
Yeah.
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua. Yeah. Is this gonna continue? Where does it stop?
I don't think it stops, Rick. You know, these billionaires, the Adelsons and the richest people in the world out of Tel Aviv, out of New York, out of Miami, Madrid, London, they're going after any sense of sovereignty anywhere in the world. And they prop up this clown, this whole circus around Donald Trump. Donald Trump says one thing one day and everyone's tweeting about it. But meanwhile, the billionaires behind them, this class of 2,800 Epstein-connected billionaires behind them, they're the ones who are truly running the world. Are they going to go after China next? I mean, and China's more and more isolated. When they take out Iran, when they take out Cuba, when they take out Nicaragua, these are important economic trading partners for the Chinese and the Vietnamese. They're going to look for the next link in some type of global chain of resistance of the BRICS nations and take them out.
Yeah, I think it'll come to a head at some point. Although, let me tell you something. They ain't taking out Iran. I don't see that happening anytime soon. And I think they're only consolidating this union between China, Russia, Iran, India, South Africa, Brazil, to a certain extent. The question is, that part of the world you're an expert on, the world you taught your students in New York City about, that's a different game because it's very far away from Russia and from China and from the rest of the world. So it really is the domain of the United States. And you go back to the Platt Amendment, you go back to the laws over the years that have put the United States in dominion of that area. And they've always taken it. They've always owned it. What we're seeing now was done in Guatemala in 54, pardon me, with our binds. So it's nothing new. It's just that it just looks particularly cruel now because we're actually seeing it in real time. And back then, maybe we didn't have the cameras or the wherewithal to be able to see it happening. Do you agree?
This is the Dunroe Doctrine. This is the Monroe Doctrine resynthesized 202 years later. This is colonialism in the flesh. You walk through the streets of Haiti, Cuba, Dominican Republic, all these different countries. It's reminiscent of the colonialism of yesteryear and of the enslavement of these people. We see the Bolivian people continuing to resist, giving us hope. Of course, the what the Iranians have done, no one expected after what the U.S. did to Lebanon and Libya and Syria and Iraq all the way down the line that the Iranians would stand up and so far defeat this access of genocide.
What about this? Maybe we'll finish on this. Let's go positive. You ready? I just thought of something. The Russians in Africa have done some pretty impressive things. People in Africa that I have talked to, leaders in Africa, sources that I have spoken to in Africa say they welcome the Russians. They don't feel like the Russians are colonizing them. They feel like the Russians are working with them. That doesn't make the Russians angels and saints. I'm sure the Russians have, you know, done well in some deals that they've done in Russia, in Africa, because that's the way the world works. But it doesn't seem like it's been repressive on the part of how the Russians have treated African nations since the Russians have made an effort to go into Africa. And you could say the same thing about the Chinese. The Belt and Road Initiative has been one where, sure, again, I'll say the Chinese have not been going in there because they just want to give kumbaya, free money to everybody. There are business deals that are being done. But they're being done in such a way so that the Chinese and the Russians are benefiting these places where they're going. Here's my question. Sorry it took me so long to get here. Do you think it's possible the United States could learn from those examples and maybe take a different tact as they go into Latin America now and maybe try and build up their infrastructure in such a way so that it's not just a steal and it's not cruel and it's not about diminishing or killing or starving, as you say?
Imperialism, by definition, it's a beastly, it's a beast. By definition, it's there to extract profits, to maximize profits. So I think all of this is the dictates of capital, of the billionaires' interests that are in control. And that has nothing to do with the well-being of any Cuban children or Cuban elderly. The human element is completely lost under capitalism. Marco Rubio, Donald Trump, these reporters who lie to Mirandi every day, these propagandists, these are all war criminals. And like Mirandi said, their grandchildren will know the truth. The future of the world is multipolar. The future of Havana, of La Paz, of Nicaragua, of Venezuela, goes through Moscow, goes through Beijing. And that's what the Trump billionaires are afraid of.
So I take it as a no. You're saying it's not in their...
There's no reforming
They're not
system.
Capable of going in there and trying to work with them to actually improve their lives. They're there to basically squeeze every penny they can out of them, and that's what they're going to do. That's what you're saying.
Colonialism, capitalism can never be positive in any way. We've seen how it's played out from Africa to Vietnam to Gaza across the world. It would be too idealistic and utopian to say that and unrealistic.
And you mean crony capitalism because, you know, business works. If you own a business and you sell to your neighbors, that's a good thing, right?
Definitely. I'm talking about U.S. imperialism.
The
U.S. system and how they've treated the entire hemisphere as their backyard. This is criminal. And this is the number one cause. Whatever issue we want to focus on, the underlying roots of the reason people are suffering across the hemisphere is U.S. intervention and imperialism.
And we're watching it play out. This is a really smart conversation, Professor. Thank you for being with us, Danny. I really enjoyed it, man. It's good to see you again. I hope you're doing well. I know sometimes when you go on these trips, it's hard to recover. Whenever I'd go to places like Haiti or whenever I did coverage of places like this, or even where I recently just went in the Donbass and saw the place where the Ukrainians bombed a school and killed 21 kids, suddenly you wake up in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're in a cold sweat. And you're wondering what happened. And it stays with you, doesn't it?
A genocidal insomnia has characterized my life since the first time I went to Haiti and Cuba and in Palestine. So I empathize. And we do this, it's important to remember, because of the human element, which is so lost in all of the propaganda that's thrown. Thanks for the work that you do too, Rick.
My dad taught me to do that. My dad always said, fight for the little guy. Fight for the little guy.
The underdog. And that's what motivates me. I didn't have to go to Cuba and make these sacrifices. Never. The next time we talk, I'll tell you about the FBI and Homeland Security and ICE and all of the harassment because we're trying to bring help to Cuba. We're the enemy.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. And just mentioning the stories that my dad used to tell me about Cuba and how he used to always tell me when I became a young journalist, always fight for the little guy, son. I get sad. I'm actually sad right now thinking about it. And to see it unfold here again in my own country is... My dad was a man with only a fourth grade education, and he shined shoes when he was little because during that era, during the Batista regime, there was also real poverty. And one of those people you saw in Cuba and you showed us a little while ago, That was my dad, you know, some 40, 50 years ago. He's a good man.
Yeah, deeply, deeply tragic, deeply personal. And how do we break through the social media blockade on information and get out these human stories? That's our responsibility. Yeah. Fight for the underdog and honor your father's legacy.
It's what we try to do, man. Thank you, Danny. It's good talking to you, dude. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sorry. I was thinking of my dad, Paco. All right. I want to take a look now at your comments. Our exclusive interview we did yesterday with a former Marine, Kenneth O'Keefe, when he was in Tehran. Joey Brown says, "Thank you, Mr. O'Keefe, for telling the people of Iran what so many of us feel. I am so ashamed of my country's leadership right now. God help us and all our victims." Saman says, "The most haunting thing is how often people only truly break once they see the children. Rows of tiny graves cut through ideology and propaganda and nationalism faster than any political argument ever will." Kathy Ethart says, "Thank you very much for interviewing O'Keefe. Until now, we never really heard the other side of the U.S. narrative. O'Keefe said it like he saw it, and he is a very moral man. I thought your opening on how to identify lying was terrific. Thank you." Ash Bandiput says, "Thank you, Mr. O'Keefe, for being the voice of us Americans that do not agree with anything this corrupt, disgusting administration is doing on behalf of Israel." And E.T. E.T. says, "Rick, thank you for sharing this. I will watch the interview. Everyone, please share and take the time to watch this. A Jew for peace, justice, and sanity." And Texter GLA says, "I believe his people knew about Starblitzk murders, too. There is so much blood on Trump's little weak hands." Wow. Those are some powerful comments. Thank you so much for sharing them. As usual, all the feedback is appreciated. You can check out my social media. We're on Spotify. We're on X. We're on BitChute. We're on YouTube. And lately, my God, millions and millions and millions of you have been commenting and watching, and we really appreciate that. Thank you again for being there. And thank you for allowing us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'll see you next time.